everybody. Welcome. This is the Fundamentalists Podcast. My name is Elliot Morgan, and I'm here with my podcasting partner, Dr. Peter Rollins, who is a...
I'm waiting for you to say it so I can disagree.
Yeah, he's a philosopher.
Theologian.
I'm so sorry. This is a podcast. I do comedy. But anyway, this is a podcast where we talk about life, and we talk about a mixture of, like, what's going on with, like, life and
what's going on in Elliot's love life.
And then Pete comes in and explains it through Jacques Lacan.
So yes, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
It's free therapy for Elliot.
Yes, free therapy. And sometimes we record on days when I have therapy, and it's like a double whammy.
Wow,
that's too much.
Yeah, you should be paying me for this.
I should be. Yeah.
What do you think of my new hairstyle, by the way?
I like it a lot. We both got haircuts today.
We did.
We're on the same cycles.
Went to Head Better.
Mm-hmm. Head Better in Sherman Oaks, California.
Yep. Yeah,
Johnny Blue,
he's very good. Although I think my hairstyle, I look like it's a young person's hairstyle on an old person's head. I feel like
It's definitely an old person's hairstyle too.
Is it?
No, okay. Just being very mean, but it looks good. It looks normal.
I like it. I like this kind of short, messy kind of style. I'm really pleased with it.
Cheers, man.
Hey, cheers, man.
We are drinking. Thank you. We're drinking. Let me sip first. That's rude. I'm drinking a rum and Coke because we discovered we have too much rum.
We have, like, weirdly 3 bottles of rum, and we're like, why have we got any rum in the house?
Yeah, no
and
one.
They're all half bottles.
Yep, not even a fan. I don't remember drinking any rum in 2018, and then we had 3 half-filled bottles of rum, so some parties were had. Anyway, this is, it's a podcast where we talk about life. Pete adds philosophical insight because he knows all about that stuff, and I think it's super fun, and I love doing this podcast, Pete. It's very fun for me.
Thank you.
I'm really excited for you're welcome. I'm very excited for 2019 and what we, maybe we'll do another live show. Maybe
I just noticed your socks, by the way. That's why I was a bit confused. They're very cool socks.
Thank you. For those who can't see at home, I have reindeer socks, and they're shaped in such a way that the toe is the red nose of Rudolph, and the eyes are near kind of midway up the foot, and then the antlers extend up my ankles. So,
yeah, very Christmassy.
Pretty festive.
Yeah,
I'm having a good time. And I'm also dressed like a 35-year-old father of 4 right now.
Yep.
I'm very, I live in a suburb. So, on that note, it's the holiday season. Pete, there are many Christmas parties, there are hangout sessions. And we go to these sometimes, and sometimes we don't. I got invited to one, I think last week, but I was in San Francisco, and so I didn't go. And rather than say, "Hey, I'm not going to be there," I was like, I didn't respond, and kind of like, that it's a very sweet kind of invite, but we're not like super close or anything. So I kind of just, I ghosted.
Yep. Oh, you ghosted, yep.
And then when I got back from San Francisco, I was like, "Hey, sorry I didn't make it up. The party was good. I was out of town, and I hope you had a great time." And she's like, "Yeah, I didn't see you there," or something like that. And I ended up making the joke I was the ghost of Christmas absence. Very dumb.
Not one of your best. Don't open with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I've used it like 4 times. And this would be like, but anyway, I mentioned something like that, and I think I maybe used the joke on you at one point. I keep saying it's a joke. It's not a joke. But anyway, that got us talking about the idea of ghosts, the idea of being ghosts ourselves, being present, being with people, feeling like you're there or not really there. And then this got your gears turning. And this is a very interesting episode because I don't exactly know where you're going to go. And usually I kind of have an idea. It seems like you may be, on one hand, you're thinking maybe you haven't prepared this whole thing. But on the other hand, I am very excited.
Okay. Well,
I feel like I'm getting on a roller coaster here. So what's your thoughts?
Yeah, well, when you were talking about ghosts, I was thinking about ghosts and thought, okay, this would be a good topic. Because in a way, a ghost is the presence of an absence. So the idea of
a dead person. It's a dead person.
Well, more abstractly than that. Is it ghost?
It's a translucent white figure that appears during Halloween usually. Okay, sorry.
Yes, when you've killed somebody, yeah. On a superficial level, a ghost is a dead person who remains.
Yes.
Yeah. So in other words, the person is gone, but they're still there. So at the deep level, a ghost is exactly that, the presence of something that is absent, that should be absent, and that kind of like haunts us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very insightful idea, The idea, and I think in one way we all believe in ghosts. We all have ghosts, all of us. We're all haunted houses because we're all haunted by the presences of things and people who are absent. People that we've loved and lost, people that we've hurt, people who have hurt us, people that we have tried to forget from our past. There's all sorts of people who are absent from our minds, but really they're still with us. That like, and our ghosts are all different. There might be somebody, if they walked into this room right now, your heart would stop. You're not thinking about them. Maybe you haven't thought about them for weeks or months or years.
Gary Shandling.
Which one's that?
Shandling. He's a comedian. Shandler. He's also passed away. Yeah.
He was also in Home Alone.
Gary Shandling? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. No, that's your man.
Macaulay Culkin.
Yes.
Gary Shandling and Macaulay Culkin are subtly different. But yeah. Anyway, so yes.
So... the ghost, yes, there's somebody walks in this room, and mm-hmm. but it wouldn't affect me at all.
Oh, right? I see. Yeah, yeah.
But then somebody else might walk in here and it wouldn't affect you at all, but would affect me. So we all have different ghosts. Your ghosts are different from mine. And those ghosts are often more present than the people who are present in our lives. So Jean-Paul Sartre once kind of reflected on this, and he said that if you're waiting in a cafe for somebody, right, and you're waiting and they're late, that person is absent from everybody in the cafe, but you feel the absence. Their absence is a felt absence.
Yeah, it's a presence.
Yeah, it's a presence, but not for anybody else.
This is why late people are the worst.
Yes.
They don't know that they are giving anxiety to
They're present. Well, I mean, some people are late unconsciously for that reason. It makes an impact in the sure. person who's waiting. But yeah, if you're waiting for someone to phone you, then your phone not making a sound... It is, in a sense, making a sound. You're aware of it in a way that other people aren't. Yeah. So what I'm basically saying is that the idea of a ghost, whether or not you literally believe in ghosts, it is a good way of thinking about the unconscious, that we are haunted by things that are not present in our minds. And there's a beautiful movie called Ghost Town with Ricky Gervais. I think he directed it, I think. He might have even written it. But that they kind of twist at the end. For anybody who wants to watch it, stop listening for a minute or two. It's not a massive mm-hmm. twist. But ultimately, you know, we think that ghosts are there because they can't leave the earth.
Yeah.
But actually...
What happens in the movie? Well, I'm sorry for everybody, but now I'm curious.
Yeah, well, do you say you realize that the ghosts are there because we can't let go of them?
Yeah.
Right? So it's like you realize...
That's a common kind of trope, I think. In yeah. It's like you haven't finished mourning and that kind of thing. Yeah.
That's it. And so the ghosts are there basically because you cannot mourn.
Yeah.
That's the idea, is that if you cannot mourn the loss of somebody or something, then they remain with you in an unhealthy way, in a ghostly poltergeist way.
And do you mean like you sit around and think about them all day?
No, it's actually different from that. It's weirdly that you try to avoid thinking about them so much yeah. so that you don't even know you're trying to avoid it. Like you're out all the time, you go to parties, you fill your life with stuff and you put them out of your mind. And it's that they reappear in your body. They reappear in kind of heart palpitations or...
Yeah, you're talking about true unconscious, like tried and true, you are being unconsciously affected by some relationship, basically.
Yeah, yeah. It's there without being... It's like repression, basically. Mm-hmm. It's secondary repression where you've put something down and it returns. Freud called it the return of the repressed. He said once, what you repress by day will haunt you by night, which means that during the day, if you push things down, you try to avoid them, then basically at night when you're drinking or when you're sleeping or when your defenses are lower, that repression will return.
One time, I know I've talked about this, may have talked about it on the podcast, but there was that time when I saw the devil, the demon in my bedroom, you know?
Yeah, yep.
The classic tale next to, very unhappy at the time, next to my spouse at the time, and then I feel a weight, the size and weight of my own body crawl up and lay next to me on the other side. And so I had old demon boy on my left, and then on my right, I had my spouse. And so I then was like, well, this is uncomfortable. And I remember then it
when you wanted a threesome, that's not what you had in mind.
Not even remote. I mean, kind of close.
Yes.
You know, I did want a ghost involved, but not a demon. And so anyway, I was there and I opened my eyes, black specter on the wall, and it's a fully formed figure, a humanoid figure, a black figure, nothing but blackness, and it crawls up the wall and it reaches the ceiling and it starts crawling on the ceiling toward me, and I'm thinking it's going to drop down, and I start freaking out. Anyway, a lamp eventually gets turned on, and you're not going to believe it, there was nothing there.
What?
But what I will say, and I know this isn't exactly what you're talking about, I know you're not talking about like experiences of paranormal stuff, but I will say it was at a time in my life what I would say probably arguably the darkest, like, or one of the darkest, like whatever was happening on some level, I was the definition of like, oh man, I'm not. And so maybe that was connected, I don't know, who knows?
It could be because we are, it's called projection, where we are very good at projecting out our inner world onto the outer world. Like when you think there's sharks under the bed, of course you don't think there's sharks under the bed, but you also really do believe it. Or there's somebody in the cupboard, you kind of really do believe it. And it's just one step more to actually see it. So that's what, whenever kids do it, whenever they say there's a monster under the bed, and sometimes they see the monster, they glimpse it, because the monster is in them, but they're projecting it out under the bed. So it's a very standard thing. Some people suffer from that more than others. Mm-hmm. And people who suffer from psychosis suffer from it a lot.
Yeah.
They can literally see, you know, things.
It's not that far-fetched, because like, or like extreme, I think, to experience anything like that, because I already live most of my life just obsessing over crap in my head constantly.
Yeah.
So there's already whole things happening in here that, not even to add to that, the actual unconscious stuff, which is informing all of the imaginary stuff.
Yeah.
It's like I got three stages and only one of them is even remotely reality. But I guess maybe you would argue that the other is reality too, because your unconscious is sort of like speaking the truth.
It's
that
the
is
truth.
Deeper to,
But I mean, anyone can experiment with this.
I've been listening to it on this podcast.
You've been, you haven't been sleeping. That's good.
Yeah, like, I've been sleeping. Yeah.
Anybody can experiment with this. Like, if you've got a basement in your house, a night that you are on your own, go down to the basement, turn out all the lights.
See how you feel.
Yeah, sit in a chair and start to try to imagine being frightened. Start to really open yourself up to it. Now, I wouldn't recommend you do this because it could be quite terrifying.
Oh, it's a Christmas episode.
It's a Christmas
episode.
Let's
get in the holiday spirit. When you're dead alone during the holidays.
Yeah, go to your basement.
Go to your basement, yeah.
And turn on a tap or something in the background and see how quickly you can start
that's
to manifest
a horrible
things.
Idea.
Yeah, but you'll notice
a little ambient white noise.
Yeah.
Dear Lord.
Maybe get your friend to scream quietly from another room.
Yeah, and maybe do a Bloody Mary or something.
What's that?
A Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary. You know, when you stand in front of the mirror, and I think you say Bloody Mary every time you turn around or something. And then, and then Bloody Mary when you is supposed to appear behind you.
A Bloody Mary appears behind you?
No, that would be great, wouldn't it? No,
that sounds good.
That's how I do in Vegas. I spin around when at the buffet. But it's like a legend. It's like a lore.
I'm just confused about the Bloody Mary bit. Like, why
Bloody
that?
Mary, I think.
As in a bleeding Mary, Mary Mother of God?
You know.
Not a drink?
Yeah, I don't know. And okay. I know every. But that is something like that. It's a creepy woman who's bloody. And I don't know if it's. I don't think it's the Virgin Mary. I think it's a Mary that was, like, killed in a brutal murder. And she will appear to you if you call her.
Very good. And well, the great thing about this, right, is, right, nobody believes that. It's like, of course, it's ridiculous. But I would say probably 70 to 80% of people who, say, in the dead of night on their own, went down into their basement with a mirror, twisted around three times saying Bloody Mary, would start to freak out.
Yeah.
And this is
I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine because you're a believer.
Well, I'm not, even if I wasn't a believer, I'm not enough of a, even if I was a non-believer, man, you got to really believe in non-belief to start doing some Bloody Mary stuff.
Well,
that
but here's,
stuff
here's the funny thing. Here's the funny thing. Like a lot of people who literally consciously have no belief.
Yeah.
I think I've talked about what I did once on the podcast, didn't I?
Well, let's hear it.
Okay. Well, if I've repeated myself, I am sorry. But I stole this from Derren Brown, a version of it. But I was speaking in Belfast with a group of people about religion, and 90% of the people in the room were not religious at all. And I actually asked people, I said, who here believes in God? And very few hands went up. This is Europe, you know, so very few hands. Then who believes in the devil? Who believes in ghosts, angels, demons, fairies? And virtually nobody, right? Mm-hmm. And after I got everybody to kind of affirm that, I then took out an envelope that had this satanic prayer on it. And I asked people to get a picture of someone they love on their mobile phone, and then ask somebody to come up and say this satanic curse over their loved one on their mobile phone.
What a dick.
And, and nobody moved. And I'm like, listen, I'm not telling you what I believe. You told me. I asked you. You don't believe in the devil mm-hmm. or angels or demons. So just come up. You know nothing's going to happen. And then what amazingly happened...
just in case, you know, like even if you don't believe in it, a little insurance is... Yeah,
but here, and here's the funny thing. But, yeah, because I think actually the more religious you are, the more easy you'll find it. Like I'm going like something I printed off the internet and then made a little bit more scary by changing a few words is going to affect something. But then I said to my friend Adam, who's a very secular guy, I said, Adam, will you say it over me? I said, will you say it? And he said, no way. And I said, why? And I thought he was going to say, because my wife would kill me mm-hmm. if she knew I was saying a curse over my kids. So I was like, but he didn't. He said, I wouldn't do that. And I was like, that's so weird that Adam would say that. I said, say it over me. And he wouldn't even say it over me. And he doesn't even like me. So I was like, wow, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a Freudian thing.
He didn't like you?
No, well, he does. He's a good friend, you know. But in Ireland, our friends don't like us.
Yeah, that's
true. But he...
Freud said what?
Oh, yeah. So Freud was saying that, for example, even though you know, say, your father is dead, your father can remain alive within you. You're always trying to please him or not please him or whatever. So that even when consciously you know something, unconsciously you can be caught in the grip of all sorts of superstitions, of all sorts of weird beliefs, and you're not aware of it at all. Eventually, one woman got up and did it. And it was really interesting, her story. And why she did it. Because I talked to her at the end and she said
loves
that,
attention.
Yes. She hates her
this
kids.
This is my moment. Yeah.
She actually wanted to curse her
the
kids.
The reason is she's just satanist.
Yeah, that's right. No, she said to me that she was very susceptible to everything. Because my whole talk was about how to defend yourself against gurus.
Yeah.
So my talk was really like, how do you defend yourself against charismatic individuals who will, you know, get you to buy into some sort of religious thing.
Battlefield Earth, man. I watched Battlefield Earth last night for the first time with some friends for a show that we're doing, and it's a movie, if you're not familiar, from 2000 with John Travolta, who took 23 years to get it made.
Yeah.
And supposedly it cost $70 million, but they later found out it was only cost about $40 million, and then they had to sue for $30 million and completely shut down the production company. Very interesting, but it's based on L. Ron Hubbard's science fiction book. That got us talking about Scientology, which got us talking about religion, and at one point the idea came up for me and my buddy Joe to go to a Scientology center as video experimental experiential thing, and kind of just to explore it, see what happens, and riff. And then the conversation quickly became like, what, like Joe was like, what would happen? Like, what if I get sucked in? Like, what if I end up believing? And I was like, you're not gonna, I was like, you'll be fine. I was like, I think we're okay. But you never know. And you can get, like, you never know how susceptible people are and if they're into that stuff.
People are very susceptible. Because I used to do this for a living. And you go, like, people, there's not everybody, but a lot of people are very susceptible, even when they don't think they are. And the reason why I was doing this experiment at the start of the talk was to say to people, some of you have all of these unconscious beliefs. You're not even aware of them. All I have to do is start to make you anxious. Or something bad happens in your life, and these unconscious things can start to really take a grip. So what I was basically trying to talk to people was about how easy it would be to actually convert you if I wanted to.
Yeah, yeah.
But the woman who got up to the front, her testimony was that she'd been through about 6 or 7 different religions, and she knew in herself that she was super susceptible to these superstitions, and for her it was an act of defiance against that part of herself.
Interesting. Well, that's very beautiful. Good for her.
So yeah, it was really good. It was a real affirmation for her to try to, because her life had been messed up.
Weird flex, as the kids like to say. But
what's that?
Weird flex, but okay, is the meme phrase. That
is that right? Or you see, I'm so old, I don't even know what that means.
It got hated on real quickly, but I still really like it. It's when somebody brags in a weird way, and it's like they're clearly bragging, and so you go, weird flex.
Weird
so
flex.
It's like, I did the Satanist prayer so I could prove that I'm not susceptible to things. It's like, all right, well, you know, weird flex, but all right.
All right, oh, very good.
It's well, silly, but it's fun.
Yeah. Well, she basically said like her life had been wrecked repeatedly from this susceptibility unconsciously to belief systems.
Cool.
And yeah, so it was an interesting act for her to do it.
I think we should do, by the way, a spin-off podcast called Fundamemalists.
What's that about?
It's just where I teach you about memes.
Yeah.
And explain them.
I would love that.
I haphazardly explain what you know about philosophy. Well, that's not true. You know way more about philosophy than I do about memes. Here's the thing with this is where I'm coming from with this stuff. So you got, oh, also something that's interesting about this is the way you're finding out what their unconscious beliefs are is usually tied to some action. Like you're not, it's always non-verbal. Like, you know, you check under the bed and, or you turn all the lights on because you get scared. Like there's something that you do that indicates that something else is going on. But it's interesting to me that it's always a physical, like, it is what you're doing out in the world, which is different from what's going on with me in my little, when you're imagining the world, when you're going, oh, I couldn't go down to the basement because I know what'll happen. It's like, no, you go down to the basement, you'll find out based off of what you do.
Yeah. I mean, that is what's called a fetish object. And it's very, very key is a fetish is an object that you know is not magical, but you treat it as if it is. Mm-hmm. So you know money's not magical, but actually you live your life as if it is. Or you know your duvet cover isn't magical, but you cover yourself when you hear something downstairs as if it will protect you. Mm-hmm. It's this weird thing where
feet aren't magical, but man, they're sexy.
What is that?
Feet.
Oh, exactly. Well, that's what I mean. Fetishes then come from that, is that it's some object like boots that are completely mundane, but that take on this magical dimension for us. But many of us have fetishes. Money can be a fetish. Somebody can have a picture of someone they love after they've died, and they don't mourn or cry until the picture's destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen this with families where they keep the room exactly like when the child had died, and it's only when they take the room apart that they fully experience the trauma of the death. The room's not magical, but it weirdly acts in a magical way.
Yeah, that's when your ex starts dating somebody too.
Oh yeah, that's very true as well. You think you've come to terms with it until, but the fetish is kind of in a sense the imagination that she is or he is single. Nietzsche and Marx was very into this, and Nietzsche as well. Like for Nietzsche was interesting because the common idea is that we can be very superstitious. But actually behind superstition, the world works in a very normal, unmagical way. But then Nietzsche was the one who said, no, it's the opposite. We often go around the world treating it as if it's not magical and it's normal and it works the way we would imagine it. But then weirdly, when you scratch beneath the surface, we're full of all sorts of weird beliefs and superstitions. And we call ourselves secular, we're not really. Because in that room, virtually nobody could move. And the funny thing is, somebody might say, hold on a second, but like you said, like why take the risk of saying this weird prayer that I've taken off the internet? But a religious person should be even more susceptible to doing it, because the idea that there is some supreme being out there who will destroy your child just because you said some words off the internet, I mean, that's a weird, for a religious person, that's a weird view of God. No religious person, proper religious person, will believe in a God who just goes, "What, they said those words off the internet? Yeah, I'm gonna kill their family because of that."
Yeah,
you know?
it's such a
superstitious notion.
Yeah, there's I feel like a lot of that stuff, like I wouldn't, if you asked me to go into my bathroom and do the Bloody Mary thing, I wouldn't do it. Well, I mean, I might, but I probably wouldn't. And the reason I wouldn't would be, I do, and this is, okay, so there's two things. One, sure, I'm a little bit of a believer and I'm, you know, I like my magic, but it's like, you know, why put it out there? And there's also like, I do think that there's something to psyching yourself out in like a good way. And so there's definitely gonna be a way to psych yourself out in a bad way. And it's like, why go in there and be like, oh, I'm going to get scared. Why not like there's also like, you know, there's like the neural pathways idea where it's like, and a lot of meditation stuff is like, talks about that where it's like, well, you know, your brain, if you do this, it calms your brain. So in my mind, saying a satanic prayer while objectively maybe having no power could still affect my brain in some way, because I'm just going to feel icky.
Yeah, but that's what, and this is more in philosophy terms or psychoanalysis terms, or just in terms of my work, without that dimension, just saying that, I would say that if you find it hard to do, there is something within you that is still
yes.
caught up in superstition.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that means you're susceptible to certain things in the future.
Cool.
So, part of my work in paratheology is to help people break free from that susceptibility.
Yeah.
And so in one way, of course, why would you bother doing it? But I do think that the more we can just hold those things lightly, the less those things are going on inside us.
You're in such an interesting place because you basically, like, your audience, the people, the fans of yours, I can only speak for myself, but or others of, you know, yours that I know, but like, it's a religious kind of background. So it's steeped in religion. Typically your audience is like, no, this is, and your kind of MO seems to be helping people break free from unhealthy belief systems. And therefore, they are susceptible to things. And so it's like they're susceptible, and in telling and informing that like they're susceptible, it's almost like you're going, hey, like you have to know your stuff so well, because you have to be able to back up your shit. And it's like, because you're peddling the thing that isn't being peddled, which is not satisfaction, and it's not certainty, and it's not, there's a hand guiding you. You're going, no, enter into the abyss, and you're doing it to a group of people who are more prone to literally not doing that.
Well, but here's what I would argue is actually religious people are potentially closer to being freed from it. I think the most religious community today is a secular community.
It's absolutely. Yeah. Dude.
And interestingly, I do
get into that in a second too. Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, and why I'm a theologian and why I'm interested in Christianity is, for me, Christianity is a technology designed to help you undergo and experience the death of God, which is called conversion, and then embrace the idea of love without some. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's the idea of, there's the idea of the epoch of the Holy Ghost, which is basically when you love, you, it's like the sacred is not an object that you love, but a depth dimension in the act of love itself. So the community, the community that I envisage is a community in which, you know, God is not some object that you love, but the depth dimension in the act of love itself.
Yeah.
And so that is kind of like, we interestingly, I think there's a religious dimension to things like Judaism, Christianity, etc., that can help you free you from superstition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to explore. And I think that we are in the grips of superstition as much as any period in our lives before. The tyranny of certainty and satisfaction, and the desire for gurus, and the desire for something that will help us escape our finitude is rife.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to hear a good sermon about living forever, you want to hear a good sermon about living forever, about escaping your body and entering into the stratosphere, you don't listen to a Baptist preacher, you listen to a TED talk, you know, digitally downloading yourself into the net and escaping your body. Tony Robbins, that's another version, like a more kind of self-help version. But there's lots of promises of attempting to escape. Finitude
out here in LA, I mean, it's all like, I mean, yeah, me not going in there, it is, we just replaced all the words. It's like, well, there's the universe, and the universe is what God used to be. God, if you're in the South and you're Republican, there's God, and if you're in LA and you're a liberal, it's the universe. Mm-hmm. But it's still operating under the same idea, like, it's the universe. The universe did this, is the universe showing you this and all that. It's like, yeah, but that said, I don't not buy into it sometimes because, again, you know, I like to have a good time. But I think that out here is for sure, and I do agree, and I also think there's a religious nature to the act of disbelief. I've never felt more born again than after I exited, or really truly felt myself exit that whole the world of
I mean, moving from one religion to another can be very freeing and intoxicating for a while. And I do think there's a way to use the word God that is different from the traditional usage.
Would you almost say there's... Could you explain to us how not to speak of God?
Yes, but thank you very much for advertising my first book.
Available on Amazon.
Yep. There's various ways of understanding God. In theology, there's basically four. I'll just say them very quickly. We don't have to go into them. But there's God as a supreme being, which is some being out in the world, like us, but just bigger and better, like Superman. But yeah, Superman on steroids. Mm-hmm. Then there is a notion of God as a hyper being. And this is the mystical notion, which is God is so beyond being that God, we can't name God, we can't know. God knows us, we are named by God, but all of our conceptions of God fall short.
Apophatic, is that the word?
Yeah, that's the apophatic tradition. Cool, yeah. Cool, cool. And the first one's the cataphatic tradition.
Cataphatic.
Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. That's a good word. Cataphatic.
Yeah. Cataphatic.
Cataphatic.
Yeah. So I mean, that's just what you can say. And the apophatic is there's a certain erasure of all language, and then there is this notion of the ground of being, that God is not some supreme being or hyper being, but God is the name we give to that which grounds everything. And then there is the notion that God is an event. And this, the evental notion of God is the name we give to the eruption of novelty and possibility in a given situation or moment. Mm-hmm. These are just four different ways of that in theology God has been talked about. And but the funny thing is, most people who don't think about these things, they only know the first, the idea that God is a supreme being.
Yeah, out and that's there watching.
And that's the one that's mostly critiqued by, smart theologians.
Yeah, and atheists. I mean, they tend to go.
Yeah, and the atheist, like traditional, like New Atheism, basically attacks that position. Yeah. And also a lot of people within theology. Yeah. And then by the way, the last one is very post-theistic. So that God as event can be called an atheistic notion of God, which sounds weird at first. But,
sure. Yeah. Well, what doesn't in these days, with all his ups and downs and rights and lefts? I was talking to my mother earlier today, and I was checking in on her. She had a very unfortunate thing happened to her yesterday, where her car was broken into and her purse was stolen, and a bunch of damages and bunch of losses and all this stuff. And she also runs a company, the back end of a company, and so she had payroll, all this stuff. It was a nightmare. And so I was talking to her today, and she was talking about the people, the perpetrators. And because I actually mentioned a conversation we were having, because we were kind of talking about, like, it's so weird that, like, that happens. Like, people get robbed and mugged, and you think it's never going to happen. Yeah. And we were talking about it briefly, and how kind of like I don't ever think about that. Like, yeah. I just assume kind of the best stuff is typically going to happen, and it normally does, but that stuff does happen. And so anyway, I was bringing that up to my mom and kind of, you know, venting about it, and I was like, it's just crazy. And I was like, I hate that it will leave a distrust of people kind of, you know, in your brain. And she was kind of talking about how she still felt anxious, and she could tell she felt anxious. And it's interesting, because she's not by any means a psychoanalysis person, but it was interesting, because she was like, I don't feel anxious, but she's like, I can tell just by, like, what I'm doing. She's like, it's like a anxiousness that I can't identify or not even feel sometimes, but I know it's there. And I'm like, oh, that's deep stuff, you know? And then she started kind of really quickly talking about how she had prayed for the people who had stolen from her, and how she didn't pray for them to be blessed, but that she knew that whatever led them to do that was, they had a reason to do it. There was there's a backstory. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. I was like, that's not wrong, and I don't disagree. I was like, I will say, and then the conversation quickly became kind of how, if something bad had happened, if she had been involved in the car being broken into and hurt, how my dad was like, oh, I would have just destroyed, like, he was like, I would go off the deep end and find those people, and there would be problems. And my mom was like, well, you can't hurt anybody. Don't hurt anybody if I hurt, all that stuff. You know, but it was that familial kind of, like, oh, we're going to kill this person if you mess with my family kind of thing. So anyway, all that to say, it's a long-winded conversation. All that to say, the conversation that my mom and I had was me basically going, yeah, but I was like, here's the deal. I was like, the rule is thou shalt not murder. And it, I was like, it doesn't say this in the Bible, but there's like, you know, some loopholes. Like, if your mom gets messed with or hurt, then you're allowed to kill the person. And my mom was like, no. And I was like, eh. And I was like, I appreciate the amount of empathy you have. I was like, I think it's a really good thing. I think it's a very sweet thing. I was like, I don't feel that for those people. I was like, I think those people could fall off a cliff and die, and I wouldn't care at all. And she's like, well, I hope you kind of like, she was like, I hope you experience that kind of empathy in one day. And I was like, look, I was like, I don't want to say that I don't have empathy for these people who robbed you. I was like, I don't. I was like, but I think that's something that comes after of venting and acknowledging that these people are terrible and going through other stuff before you get to an objective sort of like whatever. Because I was like, there's something about the day after getting broken into or the night after getting broken into, and all of a sudden you have a sort of like very altruistic, very loving, where it's just like,
I think some people can have that, and it's called agape. So agape, the technical term for that is agape. And agape is a name for a type of love that is not like family love. It's not sexual love. It's not love that you would have for a family member. It's this sense in which everything that exists affirms being, that everything that is not non-being. So everything that exists, from the coffee table to you, to your mom, everything that exists is saying, I am not nothing.
Yeah, it's basically like the good news of existence is, at least we're here.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and like everything's like, oh, okay, so this is happening, which is really cool. And
so it's most abstract, it's called being is the standing against the threat of non-being. And to experience agape, and it only happens briefly. Some people get it through drugs. Some people meditation. It's called philosophical love. You get it through thinking. But it's that brief experience where an enemy is still an enemy, but you see that even in the enemy, their mere existence is somehow standing against the threat of non-being.
Well, and also, I mean, meditation, drugs, and I would say prayer probably. So my mom is sitting there praying for them, and in doing so, generating agape in some capacity. And I did say that. I was like, my mom is, she's a very intelligent woman. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure you're handling it in the healthiest way possible. Mm-hmm. I was like, I just tapped the brakes a little bit, because I feel like so many people, especially nowadays, we rush immediately to justifying everything and being like, without ever going through the emotional shit show that we're all causing each other constantly. And so we're just, instead of going through it, we go, well, you know, so and so. And I'm only saying that on the back end of I think more like being on the receiving end at times. Like, it's sort of like, oh, there's all sorts of stuff
and people have to go through, you know, a lot to get to agape. But the idea of agape, someone like Paul Tillich would say, it is possible for humans to experience that, but it takes a lot of work, and it's very, very difficult. And there's two ways of doing it.
It's classic mom stuff. You gotta be my mom.
Yeah. Well, there's the negative way of experiencing it, which is when you realize that you're going to die, and maybe you almost get knocked over, or you find out you have a terminal illness. And in those moments, in a very terrifying way, you can realize that you're standing against the threat of non-being, that you exist. And in that experience, you can feel, and briefly, you can experience this threat of non-being that exists for everything, for stones and for people and all of that. And then the positive way is that somehow, through meditation or prayer or drugs or philosophy.
I love the idea of calling it a philosophical thinking. Is that what you call it?
Philosophical love.
Philosophical love. It gets love as a result of thinking.
Yeah, and it's a love that doesn't attach to one thing. It attaches to the affirmation that is all things. So it's a brief moment in which...
And the beautiful, I felt it. I think we felt it. You felt it. I mean, we all felt it. Do you feel
there,
it? You
there are
it?
Moments, you know, I think where all of us... I think it's a potentiality for all people to feel. But it comes and goes. Mm-hmm. But in that moment, it's not some new age kind of... But it's a sense in which you just realize that the existence of things is a standing against the void.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful feeling. And an enemy is still an enemy. That's the amazing thing about agape, is it doesn't make enemies friends.
Yeah.
It just means that you see, even in your enemy, that there is some sort of standing against the void.
Yeah.
A momentary standing against the void. And, you know, that's a powerful experience.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I like that we got on the subject, because in going back to, like, the Bloody Mary thing, I mean, what would you call that if not a prayer or a meditation or something like that? Like, if philosophical thinking can lead you toward love or a version, or philosophical love is a type of love as a result of thinking, I mean, what is it when you're thinking yourself into ghost town? Yeah. You know?
Well, it's not that. I'm not talking about positive thinking. I'm not talking about, like, you know, I'm not talking about kind of working yourself into thinking that things are beautiful.
Oh, but you're talking about really mindfulness and that kind of, I mean, I'm assuming if you're talking about meditation and...
Yeah, and even though I said there's drugs, meditation can do it, I mean, I might be slightly more critical of some of those, but I'm not sure, but yeah, but...
Yeah, you're not endorsing any of this stuff.
It's no, just, or not, I don't mind, but however someone gets to it, but it's, what I would say is we all... I mean, it sounds weird to say, but what everything that exists has in common is that it exists. It is that it's not nothing. And when you really understand that, briefly for a moment, you can be overcome with the incredible array of things that exist. And it's not positive thinking, but it's more just becoming aware of what you are, and what you are at your most basic is not nothing.
It would be like becoming present, like a not ghost.
Yes. Yeah, realizing your existence.
I know the word present is not exactly like that's a word that is sort of borrowed from the secular religion of like meditation, I guess. Like the like just be present. But man, if that shit doesn't work for me, like a mofo. Take a moment, if I take a second before... Usually what I'll do before going on stage, if I'm going to do a set, is right before going on stage, I take a deep breath, and I look around, and I'm like, oh, all of us are just here, and we're just trying to have a good time, and that's it. And then I'm like, we're all in this together. They want me to do well. I want them to like me. They want to like me. I want to like them. Like we're all, this is going to be fun. And I do get to do this. There's a microphone. It's going to feel very, like, stand-up is a very nice way to...
So you kind of become aware of your surroundings. I mean, that's what I mean by realizing you almost died or you're dying. Is weirdly one of the only good things that comes from nearly getting hit by a car, for example, is that it momentarily makes you very aware of your being, and it makes you very aware of the threat of non-being, and that kind of wakens you up for a moment, and it gives you an existential insight. And I think that's what you're talking about, if going on stage, is you have a moment where you become aware that everything is. That's why I don't think it's positive thinking, because it's not like, it's all it is actually a type of awareness.
It's not any kind of thinking. It's indescribable, I would say.
Honestly. And it's momentary, because you wouldn't want to live in it all the time, and you couldn't. But there are moments when it reorients you. And for someone like your mum, that actually could be... I mean, you're right. Like, some people can not do the mourning and the anger and the various stages that they have to do. And yet some people as well,
people just got it, yeah.
Yeah, got it. And also just that's their way of... They have a sense of, agape. That's hard to know. Which is hard to know whether you're doing something in a healthy way or unhealthy way. But
I feel like the people I know who have the most, generally speaking, that's not true. Many people I know who have depth of character or whatever you would want to call it, where they seem like substantial, fully formed human beings, they who also are their own person. Like, the people who I would go, oh, you're just like you, like the, where you're like, whoever you are is you. Those people, and many of them in my experience have, and in my personal life, have come very close to death, either themselves or very close, you know, someone who's, who's close to them. And yeah, I think that, like, I've never experienced anything like it, but, that feeling of, like, I'm going to die And then getting through that has got to be, I mean, if going through hard times and jumping off the cliff leads you to anything, then it would stand to reason that facing death would give you such profound insight into life that you're going to have.
Yeah.
It's going to change you. Yeah. Like, it's going to be a transformative thing.
I mean, the philosopher Heidegger, one of the great German philosophers, he writes very incredibly about death in his book Being and Time, but basically the idea that you can't really live if you don't realize that you're a being towards death. And part of what he means by that is that, and Derrida, the philosopher Derrida, talks about the gift of death, which is that actually in the threat of non-being, you actually come to experience a density to being, to life itself. And that's why some of the ancient Greeks had the belief that actually the gods needed to be saved by us. Mm-hmm. Because the gods, if you do not know what it is to
what
lose...
What is going on outside? Know, this is like the 18th siren.
I know, there's a lot going on. But in the Greek vision, if you can't die, you don't know how to live. If you can't have a threat to your being, my God, yeah, you're right.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. if you don't have a threat to your being, you can't appreciate it. Just like if you can't lose anything, you don't know what it is to really have it. And so the idea was that the gods had to become mortal in order to experience salvation. But that plays with this idea that in a negative way, realizing your own death has a positive dimension to it.
Yeah. I think it's the best motivator in the world, and probably the healthiest, because it's the most based in reality more than anything.
Yeah.
But
death and taxes. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like anytime I'm get kind of iffy or whatever, I'm like, I'm going to die. Like, who gives a crap?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't, like, do this stuff, which I don't know. I'm in a real kick right
Although
now.
For Heidegger would say, what's that?
I'm on a real kick of just doing shit. That's my whole, talking to Joe, and I did a really fun podcast. It was just me and him on the Valleycast, which was really cool. But we were talking about action, and it's just like, not only does action, like we were talking about earlier, but like action is what reveals the actual unconscious beliefs that you have, at least in terms, I mean, would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's the your parapraxis, your unregulated
actions.
Well,
you would say parapraxis. Yeah. your what actions? So, the little things.
Yeah, the actions that aren't authorized by your consciousness.
Okay, well, either way, still an action, right?
Yeah.
Well, I guess not really, because I'm talking about making a decision and doing something. But I guess, generally speaking, I feel like when you actually do things, life moves forward, and it's affirming the fact that you're alive more so than just staying in your head and doing stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I would say this is what Tillich would say. He would say that to exist is to affirm existence. So, you know, that idea that everything that exists stands against the threat of non-being. But then the deeper type of being is where we can affirm more. So, for example, if you can't leave the house because you're afraid, then you're still affirming life because you exist, and you affirm life in a variety of ways, but you could affirm life in a wider way that would be healthier. And so, you know, hopefully through therapy or whatever, you can begin to go outside. So yeah, the more you can affirm life in wider ways, probably the better. Now, I would say the point of experiencing and acknowledging your own death is not so much to say that nothing matters, but bizarrely, it then makes everything matter.
Yeah.
It makes everything important. And that's why actually there's a philosopher, Gabriel Marcel, who said that you can come to terms with your own death. You can think, oh, I'm going to die, and it can make no difference. But he says that the death of someone you love, that is more destabilizing. Because even if you come to terms with your own death, it's hard to come to terms with the death of someone you love.
I was talking about that with my mom today. I was like, there's the difference between being the person who experiences the bad thing and being the person who loves the person who experienced the bad thing
is
a big difference. Like when it's someone who you love, I mean, my car got broken into, you know, I would have forgotten six times by now. I wouldn't, that's an exaggeration, but like, the fact that it's somebody else is like, oh no. And then if you add death to that, it's like, oh my God, that's what it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that is, the closest that, that people come to is, well, generally speaking, unless there's barring a personal thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when a loved one is leaving, that's.
And it's a terrifying thing. So Gabriel Marcel, one of his jobs, during the, I think it was the First World War, It wouldn't have been the Second World War. I'm trying to think. Actually, might have been. But one of the World Wars, he was writing in the mid-20th century, was telling parents that their loved ones had died, their children had died. And of course, so firsthand, he saw how devastating it is for parents to lose a child.
Unfathomable.
Yeah. And so, you know, when Marcel writes about this, it's not like a kind of like, oh, it's an enlightenment type of thing. It's like genuinely, utterly destabilizing.
Almost, it'd be you're murdering people. You're murdering. You're walking up to somebody's front door and you're basically killing.
You're destroying them. Absolutely.
Part of them.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so
God, what a horrible.
So when he wrote about this, but he was writing about this. Like that you can come to terms with, oh, I'm going to die, but there's something that is just really hard to come to terms with, maybe impossible, especially when it comes to children. You can come to terms, I think, with your parents dying more because you expect it, but something about your children dying that is just horrific.
Yeah.
But then he uses this as a way of exploring what does it mean to be. He does some interesting work.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I don't think you've mentioned him before.
Yeah, no, he's a smaller French theorist, but I like him a lot. He was an interesting guy, not so well known, but he was big at the time. Gabriel Marcel. He's very conservative. I don't agree with him, and that's why I like him. As I think, honest, smart conservatives are some of the best people to read. They're brilliant, and Gabriel Marcel is a bit like that.
Yeah.
Cool.
I had a joke there, but I'm not gonna say it because I feel like it was low hanging fruit.
You still got a cold, man?
Yeah, man. This freaking thing. God, I don't remember what I was gonna say.
Yeah.
Anyway, how are we doing? What are we doing on time? How you feeling?
I'm feeling good. Do you want to do some takeaways?
Yeah, man. My takeaway. So this was a good one. I like this. I like this podcast.
Oh yeah.
I like this episode.
Yeah. Me too.
I was worried.
I like the way we get very meta at the end. We kind of analyze what we thought about the podcast while the podcast is still happening.
Yeah.
What did you think? How did you think it went?
Yeah, that's the takeaway. That's a pretty good episode. Yeah. What would be... Well, let's take a moment.
Yeah. Take a moment, contemplate the Christmas tree of despair, and think about the takeaway.
Look at it in all its beauty. Look at it in all of its beautiful sadness.
Yeah.
It is, gosh darn, if that is not a mall Christmas tree.
Mall Christmas tree, yeah.
It's like I went into the grove, grabbed a Christmas tree. Like if you imagined in a park it just being like 10 of these in a row, like along a sidewalk in a outdoor shopping center, it would make sense. Anyway.
Yeah.
I guess my takeaway would, I'm going to be thinking on the ghosts stuff a lot, because I feel as of late, I was like, you know, you always get you go through ups and downs and you're like, oh, I got it. I figured it out. And then it's just life is a constant state of whatever. It's like, I got it. Like, I understand it. And then you dip back down and it's like, I don't know, man, maybe there's all sorts of ghosts going on in here that I will never know about and will never really be able to come to terms with. And that's going to be the case. So let's all, you know, get along and be merry and say nice things to each other.
Wow. Look at that. That's beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Wow. And you said all that philosophical stuff and then I swooped it in at the end with that deep comment.
You know, my takeaway as well is connecting the ghost story at the beginning with the death stuff at the end and go like, because the ultimate form of a ghost is when someone you know dies, someone you love dies. That's the ultimate ghost. Because they remain present with you even when they're gone.
Yep.
And the problem is if we don't mourn and we don't kind of bring them to mind and bring them into consciousness, that ghost will become a poltergeist, will damage us, will destroy us. But we have to learn to mourn. And so whether the person you love has died or you're not with them, or is somebody, you know, you broke up with and they're with somebody else and you have to just, you know, kind of wishing the best or whatever, whatever it is.
You have to say the right words.
Whatever, you know, we all have ghosts, whether they're dead or not.
Yeah.
Is that the healthiest thing to do is in some way not avoid it. That's what Heidegger meant by confronting death, is you confront the loss, your loss, the loss of one you love, you confront it. And that sounds like the most horrific thing, but actually in confronting the loss, it can actually infuse your life with depth. And that depth is sometimes horrific. It's horrible sometimes, like, but it's better than the alternative. And, you know, other, if we don't, we close ourselves off, we live shallow lives, we don't experience the depth and density of existence. So the takeaway for me is, what is your ghost? Is it a literal person who has died? A child or a parent, a loved one? Is it someone that you've lost who lives on the other side of the world? Someone who you are estranged from, a child who you mm-hmm. can't see? And how do you make space for that absence in your life? How do you confront it, knowing that there is a gift in confronting that absence?
You know, I'm reminded of the great philosopher, my therapist, Dr. Gary Penn, book available now, who Wednesday I said the words, because y'all, I try to guess what he's going to say. I try to say it before he says it so that he doesn't think I don't know it, even though I don't. I need to hear it. I was like,
you're always, I want to have sex with my mother.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I was like, before you say anything,
yes.
Let me just get this one out of the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know, man. I was like, I guess the only thing to do is just kind of sit in it. And he just goes, no. And it's very rare that he does that. Usually he's just, you know, they do the whole, like, they do the thing where they're like, you know, they kind of tell you that what you're doing is right. And then they guide you. But he goes, no, you move on. And I was like, shit. I was like, that's not what I wanted to hear. It was exact. It's like the same. It's like you, that's the ghost part. And then that's the not, the whatever you'd call it. I don't know. Screw it. All right, cool. Well, thank you, Pete. This is very fun. I appreciate it.
Wonderful.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.